Welcome to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm Eddie Garcia. The Crossroads Concert Series is returning to the Southeastern Center for Contemporary Art, and we've got interviews and music from both acts on the bill. Solo guitarist William Tyler cut his teeth as a sideman in Nashville, Tennessee, before setting out on his widescreen guitar journey. He's in Winston-Salem on Saturday night, and he'll be filling Seco with exploratory and scenic instrumental guitar work with notes that ring louder than words. But if lyrics are your thing, you're in luck. Co-headlining the concert is His Golden Messenger, the vehicle for the searing songs of MC Taylor. He stopped by WFDD with guitar in hand and sat down for a conversation and intimate performance. While you're at Seca, if you happen past an old cigarette machine and do a double take, then you've encountered an Artomat. The machines are filled with affordable handmade art, and founder Clark Whittington is here to talk creativity and commerce. Then we'll go behind the scenes with Mary Dalton. All coming up on Triad Arts Weekend, after this news. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm Eddie Garcia. This weekend, the Southeastern Center for Contemporary Art, SECA, is hosting the 10th installment of its Crossroads Concert Series. The concert's on Saturday, July 26th, and performing are His Golden Messenger and William Tyler, two artists off the Merge Records roster, the premier independent music label in North Carolina that's been celebrating its 25th anniversary this very week. Later in the hour, we'll have David Ford's interview with MC Taylor, the voice behind His Golden Messenger, as well as a few songs played live in Studio A. But first, William Tyler. Growing up in Nashville, Tennessee, William Tyler was raised by a father who wrote songs for the likes of Eddie Rabbit and a mother who called Alex Chilton of Big Star a friend. He spent his early 20s playing as a sideman with the band Lamb Chop, and along the way, he also strummed alongside Bonnie Prince Billy and Silver Jews. As a solo guitarist, William Tyler uses the instrument as a wide-angle lens. His music evokes images of America's panoramic past and the unsettling path taken from the 1950s to the present. His guitar playing is nimble, but not showy. His use of effects is a component, but never a crutch. He uses open tunings and infuses elements of drone, psychedelia, and pure experimentalism, but his music remains wholly accessible. When I spoke with William, he was sitting on a porch in Durham, North Carolina, a day before he took the stage at Baldwin Auditorium to kick off a series of concerts celebrating 25 years of Merge Records. What kind of music did you play as a teenager? Like, what kind of stuff were you doing?
It was very, like, 70s-influenced power pop, rock pile, Elvis Costello, The Jam, that kind of stuff. That was kind of the limit of my guitar vocabulary. It was, like, playing rhythm guitar, you know, maybe kind of like Buddy Holly style, like, sort of leads, but rhythm. So when I ended up in Lamb Chop, I actually started out on keyboard as kind of a textural keyboard player.
Now, how did you get recruited as a keyboard player?
Well, I knew Kurt, the singer, and I knew the other Lamb Chop guys. You know, they were one of those bands around town that I would try to go see them whenever they played, and I just got to be friends with those guys, and I think that Kurt probably just thought that there was sort of a novelty factor in asking somebody that was so much younger to play in the band, because everybody else in the band was like 15 years older than me.
Right.
I didn't even own a keyboard at the time, but I like went on eBay and like found a Farfisa and started practicing for a couple months and, you know, tried to learn all their songs, and then it just stuck, and then I was in the band for 12 years.
Wow. And then just during that time, you kind of switched over to playing guitar with them?
Yeah, I joined when Nixon came out. Then there was kind of a big turning point after that album where I think he realized that he couldn't financially support like a 13-piece band and also have everybody have day jobs. And so when we did the next record, which was the first record I actually played on, Is a Woman, the whole sound of the band changed drastically, and it sort of got sonically reduced. They all kind of liked the way I played rhythm. And I just sort of like apprenticed or worked my way up to, by the end of the time I was in the band, I was essentially the primary guitar player. But that was, you know, that was over a course of, you know, almost 10 years.
And during that time, were you also performing as a solo artist, like trying out your own stuff in clubs, or was it just focused on Lamb Chop?
Not really. I just sort of backed away creatively from doing anything on my own. I mean, I look at like the first 4 or 5 years that I was in Lamb Chop almost kind of like a college frat experience, you know, like just going out with a bunch of older guys, getting drunk all the time and like trying to be in a band. I mean, not that we were a huge party band. I sort of feel like when I was younger, I was writing all my own songs and I was, you know, very creatively focused. And then that didn't work out. I just sort of put off thinking about doing my own music. And then at some point when I was about 25, 26, I started teaching myself how to play the fingerstyle way, which worked well within the context of playing with Lamb Chop. But I just realized, oh, yeah, this is actually like a form of music that I really feel like I could get into. I mean, it was, you know, you get into it largely because it's almost like it's a solo activity. So it's very therapeutic. It's like painting or you know, long distance running or something. I mean, it doesn't involve the input of other people. And when you're trying to find your voice creatively after a period where you've felt a little listless, doing something like that can be very empowering and meditative. And I wasn't good at it for a really long time. I remember the first couple times I did it in front of people, there was enough of a reaction to where I felt like, okay, I think this might be something I should pursue, at least just as a hobby. I didn't ever intend it to be a serious pursuit. Yeah, so there was a transition period where I was doing it. I put my first record out when I was like 28, 29. And then that was kind of, I guess, right at the end of where sort of my full-time involvement in Lamb Chop started winding down a little bit at the same time. But it was all happened in a very like natural way. Mm-hmm.
That first record, Behold the Spirit, you know, it's full of finger-picked acoustic guitar playing, but you also have some tracks like Signal Mountain or To the Finland Station, mm-hmm. you know, that are much more mm-hmm. ambient in nature with little dissonant touches and volume swells and eerie layers of static. How did those elements start finding their way into your music alongside the guitar playing?
I think from a pretty early point, I was interested in integrating noise and sound, other sound elements. I never looked at it, any of this, as being some sort of pure expression of being a solo, quote, solo guitar player. Now, I had to do that just because out of necessity, but I think, like a lot of people, I was influenced by the Jim Rohrt stuff from the late 90s, early 2000s, you know, Papa M, all the Thrill Jockey mm-hmm. stuff from Chicago. A lot of the more experimental stuff that was on labels like Silk Breeze. I think with Behold the Spirit, I mean, it is primarily an acoustic. I feel like it's sort of like the acoustic guitar is like the lead singer, but there's all these other cast members in it. And I just like, I kind of wanted to do a cycle of things that where there was like these sort of gaps of ambient space, and it gave a little of relief to the melody and the, I don't know, it just sort of worked out that way. That's always been something that's really interested me, sound collage and all that. So.
Well, then your next record, Impossible Truth, which was released in 2013 on Merge Records, that saw more of that stuff coming up to the forefront, and you're playing electric guitar on that one for the most part, mm-hmm. correct? And there's more layering going on, and there's a little more obvious, not over the top, but obvious treatment with effects and things like that. The results are really cinematic. Are you heavily influenced by film, and not just film scores, but by film in general?
Yeah, I'm both, actually. Mm-hmm. I was always interested in film. I mean, when I was before I got really interested in music, when I was a teenager, I was really, really interested in film. I mean, I watched hundreds of movies and read film books, and I mean, I was really interested in pursuing that somehow. But I also realized that it's really expensive to make films, even like home movies.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, this is probably not something I can just do myself. But yeah, I was always interested in the synthesis of film and music, and a lot of my favorite directors, like Kubrick or Herzog or whoever, have always figured out really touchstone ways of doing that. I mean, I was just use a specific example. It's one that actually comes out. I mean, Popova is like one of my biggest influences stylistically, and I wouldn't have known about his music were it not for his Herzog soundtracks. So yeah, I mean, that there's definitely, I mean, I like it when people make those comparisons. I mean, Reichhuter is a big influence. I mean, I don't necessarily imagine visuals when I'm writing those songs, but I guess, like when you say the word cinematic and like trying to, I think especially with Impossible Truth, I was trying to draw on that a little more, like make it almost sound like a soundtrack to an imaginary film.
Well, when you're listening to it, or I can say as a listener, you know, if like driving in the car listening to it, it almost makes you start to feel like you're in a movie. Like you almost can see yourself driving the car. Does that make sense?
Yeah, well, it's an album that's sort of about kind of the West, and not that it's a Western, but I mean, there's a lot of wide open space, and the sound's very big, and I totally understand that. I mean, I've had the same effect listening to similar style music, driving, and you know, long drives, and kind of imagining things, and that's one of the things that I like about writing instrumental music is that it's not immediate, I guess, but it does allow a lot of space for the listener to conjure up different ideas, images, and associations that would not exist there with the tyranny of lyricism and, you know, being told a story by somebody. And, you know, there's a certain comfort in that, but there's also a certain freedom in just listening to music without words and being able to make your own associations.
And you're playing on the record, you have elements of, you know, drone and psychedelic music for sure, and like we're saying, like with the ambient textures and whatnot. But a lot of your songs, they come back to a reoccurring theme or like a hook of some sort. How much are you thinking about structure when you set off writing a song, or, you know, is that something more that kind of comes later?
I usually write songs in fragments. Sometimes I even put together, I mean, most of them are in alternate tunings, and it'll be sort of, sometimes it'll be almost like you're like storyboarding something, and it's kind of like, oh, this is in that tuning, this is in that tuning, and then you figure out a way to fuse them, and they might be two or three different themes, and then they become a song. Yeah, they're very structured, very, I mean, I just played a show where I opened for Peter Walker. I know you actually touched on that in one of your last emails, and I respect his music, but it was interesting, like as a contrast, I mean, he doesn't compose. I mean, everything he does is based on the theories of Indian classical, and, you know, then he got really interested in flamenco. But essentially, like, his playing is all about showcasing and exercising and modes, improvisational or not. And I'm sort of exactly the opposite. I don't want to necessarily say I'm a composer, but, I mean, I don't really improvise. I'm not comfortable with improvisation. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's good. I like improvising as well, but the way I write is very structured, very linear, very melodic. I mean, there was one review one time that said something like it was almost too melodic or something. I can't remember the phrase, but I thought that was funny, and I was like, yeah, I could actually see that as being a valid criticism. But, I mean, that's just the way it comes out. I mean, you know, I started out writing pop songs, and my dad is a country songwriter, and, you know, there's sort of a classic form of songwriting that I guess does come out in the way I write. Mm-hmm. But, you know, those are all very good points that you made about the way it comes out.
One want to talk about one more song on Impossible Truth before we move forward to talking about Lost Colony a little bit. World Set Free, the last track, it's 10 minutes, and it really is, you know, not to keep saying using the phrase journey or whatnot, but it really is a journey, because you have this sense of hope, but then kind of some decay starts seeping in on the back end of the song. I mean, was there a particular inspiration for this song, or was it a product of assemblage? Or
there's essentially two melodic themes to that song. I never play it live because it's pretty tricky to pull off solo. But it sort of was inspired by Rhys Chatham, and I'm always imagined it as being this like circular minimal theme that was linear but that kept building. And then sort of the B part to it, when I came up with that part, I was like, oh, this could actually be a song that has some movement to it. But you know, I wanted Impossible Truth to be a conceptual work about my theories of like the end of the world and apocalypse, and The World Set Free is the title of an H.G. Wells book that deals with the concept of atomic warfare. But I mean, he didn't call it that. He wrote it in the very, very early part of the 20th century, and he sort of prefigured the concept of, you know, the world blowing itself up with this new weapon. But anyway, that's the name of the book. Mm-hmm. And there's the decay theme is very directly inspired by this piece by Gavin Bryars called The Sinking of the Titanic, where you hear the sound of the band playing on the deck of the ship going down, and then you hear the music literally like going underwater. So I was trying to like come up with something that sort of was that, like you hear all this kind of like the equivalent of like an explosion and then this gradual decay at the end. So yeah, it's a very cathartic piece. I mean, I think it only really would have worked at the end.
Yeah.
But like I just said a few minutes ago, it's one of those songs that I play live like very rarely, just because it just isn't as effective. Even when I sort of loop all the stuff, it just doesn't really work without a bunch of people playing on it.
Speaking of playing with others and other instruments coming in, your latest EP, Lost Colony, that's a full band affair, or it sounds like a full band affair. Who are you playing?
Yeah, it is.
And who are you playing with? And what led you to the decision to, you know, deviate from just playing solo?
It's three guys that I'm friends with from Nashville who all play in a bunch of different bands. And basically what happened was I got asked last year to play at Bonnaroo, and they didn't want to book me solo, which was kind of funny because I was like, well, that's the only way I play. but instead of just reacting, you know, I thought, well, you know, it'd be cool to play that. And so I was like, well, I'll put a band together. And I didn't even really know how I would do it. I'd played with Jamin, the guy who plays drums. I'd played a couple of times with him when we had worked up a couple of songs. We just managed to get a set together, and then we played a few times, and people were just so into it, and I could tell that it sort of broadened the appeal of that kind of music to a crowd of people that wouldn't necessarily react to it if it was just me up there by myself, because there's understandably a lot more power when you've got, you know, bass and drums and other instruments. Played a couple of shows, and people were, you know, throwing out all these comparisons that I thought were interesting, like, you know, everything from The Dead to Barefoot Jerry to Sonic Youth. And I was like, ah, that's cool. And so it kind of got me thinking about instrumental music in a different way. I never went into it thinking I'm going to be a solo guitar guy. I just thought, well, you know, it would be interesting to document this band in a very explicit way. And so when we recorded the tracks for Lost Colony, we essentially tracked it live. I'm happy with how it came out. I think I don't know if it's necessarily a direction I'm going to go in fully, just because logistically you have to think about how you can tour and, so, you know, support your own music in the context of like actually going out and presenting it to people. So it's hard to think about, like, you know, at the age of 34 starting a band, you know, and trying to figure out how to do that again, you know, all over again. But having said that, I mean, it definitely presents the music to people that wouldn't necessarily have any interest in it otherwise.
I really like the cover you did too. I guess
the carousel, yeah.
Yeah, the krautrock thing. And that was really cool. And I've never heard the original version, but I'm guessing some of that slide work, is that sitting in for like keyboard or synth sound?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. The pedal steel is essentially
pedal steel, okay,
doing kind of a synthesizer part. Luke Schneider is the pedal steel player. A lot of that kind of music in its original form is very static. And I mean, not in a bad way. It's just, it doesn't... It exactly mirrors like the sort of hypnotic vibe of driving on the interstate or the autobahn or whatever, you know, whatever inspired it. But like, I wanted to try to reconfigure the song to build a little bit. And yeah, I mean, I think it came out really cool, but it's also just like as far as you could get from, I don't know, Tacoma Records. I mean, I guess part of me was trying to be like, I mean, hopefully not in a forced way, but I mean, part of me was trying to make a statement of like, hey, I'm not just influenced by this stuff. I also am influenced by this stuff.
But it still has your sound all over it, which I think is really cool. I'd say well, someone so familiar with the music, it's unmistakably you, but it's just with a new propulsion, you know?
Yeah, that's interesting to hear you say that. I get, you know, one thing that I do think probably makes what I do a little more unique is just the fact that I'm friends with a lot of people that are in the solo guitar world. I mean, we all kind of have to stick together because we're making such marginal music and we're all friends with each other. But having said that, not a lot of people who are doing it actively came at it the way I did, which is, you know, I started at it a little bit older, but also coming out of being a side person. And I have a technically probably very limited vocabulary with the guitar, but it's definitely my own voice. But it's like I'm so used to being a musician with other people, especially in an ensemble like Lamb Chop. Like, in a way, playing with a band made it was like, oh yeah, I remember what this feels like, because now it's not just you, it's all these other people, and you can find kind of like a way to be almost like a supporting voice in that. Playing solo guitar, I mean, you have to be, I mean, you're the only person there, and it's a very dominant approach. Every aspect, you have to be... I think it's probably why it works a little bit better on acoustic, because you have, like, this wide range of, like, bass and treble and resonance, and it makes up for a lot of other instruments not being there. But, yeah, it's interesting that you say it still sounds like me. I'm not even sure if there is... I guess I can't be objective about it. I can't tell if there's a sound that sounds more like me or less like me.
Right.
I mean, I guess I don't analyze it that much.
That's good. So you have a podcast called It's All True, and it's not just about music. You know, episode 2 is entitled Noise, Nostalgia, and Radio. Tell us what you're doing with the podcast.
I just wanted to synthesize a lot of different things. I mean, I don't write lyrics, but there are a lot of stories in the songs that I write, but also I'm just very interested in history and philosophy and science and, you know, lots of other things that are not necessarily musical, but definitely influence the way I think about music and the way I think about art and everything. And I guess I just thought it'd be interesting to try and do something that was a forum to share that with people. I mean, it doesn't really have to work in harmony at all with like what I'm doing as a guitar player. It's a totally separate thing, but it's been really fun. I've done two, like you mentioned, and I guess there's part of me, honestly, that, I mean, I didn't go back to school, and there's part of me that probably always fantasizes about retreating into, like, academia and, or not retreating, but, you know, being in that world, and yeah. I guess I am trying to, like, make what I do bigger than just music, and I want it to be about other things and get people thinking about other things, more importantly. Thank you.
guitarist William Tyler. You can see William perform live on Saturday, July 26th at 7 p.m. at Sika. It's the 10th installment of the Crossroads Concert Series, and he'll be co-headlining with His Golden Messenger. For ticket info, music, videos, and a link to William Tyler's podcast, visit WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. We have to take a short break, but when we come back, we go behind the scenes with Mary Dalton, bear witness to an intimate live and Studio A performance from His Golden Messenger, and pull the levers of Artomat with Clark Whittington in 60 seconds when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm Eddie Garcia. In about 15 minutes from now, we'll stroll down to Studio A for a live performance from His Golden Messenger. But first, a look at vended art.
I'm Bethany Chafin. Most art is sold from or housed in a museum, a gallery, a studio, found on the walls of a restaurant, or maybe displayed in a garden or public space. So one place you might not expect to find it is being dispensed from a refurbished cigarette vending machine. The concept is called Artomat, and with $5 and a sense of curiosity, a piece of art from an Artomat can be yours. From wearable art to woodblock landscapes, Polaroid photos, handmade miniatures, even a mini robot made from capacitors, the possibilities for the things you can find in an Artomat are endless, as long as they fit into a 3x2-inch box. The Artomat and the artists behind it aim to produce progressive art that's both personal and accessible. Winston-Salem-based Clark Whittington is the man behind the Artomat, and he stopped by WFDD to tell me more. Tell me how the concept first came to you and what year. Was it 97 from what I understand?
Well, I started Artomat in 97. The original machine was based on an observation that I had. A lot of my art at the time was conceptual and documenting encounters, experiences, things like that. And in the late 80s, when I worked at a printing company, a friend of mine, he had a Pavlovian reaction to snack wrappers. So he'd go to a vending machine when he'd hear the crinkle of someone opening something from a vending machine. So I sketched that in a sketchbook, and it sat dormant there for a while until I moved to Winston in 97. And that was the time when cigarette machines were being banned, and I got one for free and converted it into the first Artomat. After that, the owner of the coffee shop, Penny University, Cynthia Giles, she said, "We can't let you take this. We love it too much." So we started inviting artists to help keep it filled. So that's where Artomat went from a me to a we. It's more of a collaborative sort of relationship now with anywhere from 300 to 400 artists from around the world at any given time.
Were you working on that size, that scale before that, or was it kind of an adjustment where your piece is a little bit larger than that and you had to scale down?
Yes and no. I did some 2-inch by 3-inch paintings back in the late 80s when I had a gallery in Charlotte. So I'd stretch little miniature canvases. And the reason I did that is because a lot of my art was not sellable. A lot of it would end up in dumpsters after the show at times. And, you know, I just wanted to focus on the idea and the concept, and sometimes the quality just wasn't there. So I got tired of moving these canvases around and carrying them around, so I worked small with that. Maybe that led to the small work that went into the initial Artomat, but I consider the first Artomat as one of 13 pieces in that show at Penny University back in June of 97.
Could you describe the actual vending machine itself? Because if you go on your website today, you can see images of all of them that are now across the country. And The vending machines themselves are beautiful, and they all have a character, it seems. So what did that first one look like?
Well, it looks about the same. This machine is still in operation at Mary's Gourmet Diner down in the Arts District. It's pretty rough. It's humble. I find it that it's beautiful, but it's pretty raw around the edges. So that machine came from, what I can tell, it came from the original West End Cafe, the little small cafe. And I didn't have any money at all to do any cosmetic stuff. So I found scrap roofing paper and my airbrush and acrylic paint, and I just spelled out Artomat and stuck it on there. That was originally selling things for $1, 4 quarters, and then nowadays it's geared for tokens.
Could you tell me how, you know, that $5 is divvied up? Some of it is going to the host site, is that right? And
yes.
Some's going to the artist, mm-hmm. And how does that work?
When I started this, I had no idea I'd be doing it full time. I was just wanting to sell art cheap and get it into people's hands. So we've sort of adapted over the years, and we've kind of worked ourselves into a corner with the $5 price point, where most people who aren't familiar with art, they're not terribly uncomfortable spending $5 to experience something that they may not quite understand. That makes it harder for us as artists to produce at that price point, but end of day, it allows people to experience art. So that's the main goal. When it comes down to the breakdown of the money, the artists are doing most of the heavy lifting, so they get 50%, so that's $2.50. And the host gets $1.50 because usually they pay a fee up front to make a machine happen and they bring it to their community. And that can be quite expensive for some venues across the country or some of our venues out of the country. It can be very expensive. So they're committing to our mission and our mindset. Our studio gets $1.
That reminds me of something I've read that you commented that the Artomat sort of is contradicting the cliches around art. And I'm wondering what you see or saw as some of those cliches and how that actually works, how it's contradicting those.
So what I found is if you do your best to explain art to people in a genuine way and not in a way that would look down on them or be condescending, they respond very well. So I think when it comes to the art world, there's a lot of stigma that is meant to be for the elite or the rich. And Artomat is very affordable, and we're reaching people who may have never bought art or never visit museums.
So how does someone become an artist that is featured in an Artomat machine?
The world is invited to participate. I want to share this with anyone who feels that it's up their alley. I feel as long as it's worth $5 and doesn't get anyone in trouble, we can find a place for people's art. So I hope that more artists would step up. Right now, we do need high quality work that really stands strong after the purchase and after the buyer has walked two or three steps away from the machine. Because that's what really makes magic happen when people realize, wow, look at that.
So this sort of all started at Penny University. That was a coffee house in Delhi, right?
It was a coffee house down off Brookstown.
Okay, neat.
Yeah.
So how did it grow and where are Artomats today?
The first few months, we started hitting up some places like had a machine at Morning Dew Coffee Shop. And then places like Green Hill Center was like our third venue. That's in Greensboro. So we now have about 120 machines around the country and some outside the country. One in Vienna, Austria, two in Australia, one in Vancouver, British Columbia, one in the UK somewhere. It's a new venue. They're going to move their machine around, temporary venue. So I don't really know where that machine is right this minute. But anyway, all of these venues just really acted like they wanted to be a part of Artomat, and that makes it a lot easier to have a working relationship.
So you have a swap meet coming up in D.C. Could you tell me a little bit about that?
Yes. This is something we do periodically, usually every 5 years during an anniversary. We'll have this thing called a swap meet. We have them every once in a while on off years, and we're having one in Washington, D.C. this July. But a swap meet is basically kind of like an arts fair for Artomat, where artists will set up tables for the day and show people what they do and meet each other, show off some of the larger work, and then they'll swap Artomat pieces with each other and walk home with a collection. We did something like the third year called a convention. What we noticed was, Artomat artists were really excited to meet each other, because they realized they have something in common. But then B, they would trade Artomat art. And so we noticed this, they were having this collection. So it was kind of cool that no money was changing hands. They were just swapping little pieces of art. So I just decided to call it a swap meet. So we've had one on the 5th anniversary, the 10th. The 15th was at the Lucy Center at the Smithsonian American Art Museum a few years back, and we're having this one there again because they liked it so much, and they said some of their patrons asked when we're going to have another one. So this one is not going to be nationally per se. It's more of a regional for DC area artists, but we're also artists from the East Coast are coming to it as well.
Great. And who are some of those artists who are going to be there?
Locally, we have a few speakers, and I'm excited for this because we've never had that before. We usually would just have a band and things like that. But this time we're going to slow it down a little bit and have a few people really talk about things that maybe is hard to understand online or things like that. So one person that's going up is from Winston-Salem is Mona Wu, and she's going to discuss how she's a member of Artworks as well as an active Artimat artist. And she's going to kind of convey how the Artworks co-op has kind of embraced Artimat to make work as a group and how that benefits the exposure of the gallery locally as well as nationally. So I'm excited about that because Artworks is the only co-op adult artists who have pulled together to make Artimat art for us. We've had classes. In many cases, the teachers had to assign the students to pull together and work as a collective. But in regard to adult artists, it's unique that they actually get along and can work together for a common goal, something like this. So that's really nice. Then we have a few other artists. One artist from Virginia, Lisa Marie Adams, she's going to discuss how she had a mental block for a year before she got the courage to submit her prototype to Artimat. So I think that's going to be interesting to hear because I think we all go through that. I think sometimes artists, we overthink it. A few other artists who will be coming up from North Carolina is Jennifer O'Kelly and Brian Cunningham.
Artimat inventor Clark Whittington. And as Clark says, the world is invited to participate. And this weekend, artists and interested parties will be meeting at the Mid-Atlantic Regional Swap Meet at the Luce Foundation Center at the Smithsonian American Art Museum in Washington, D.C. For more information on Artimat, to see pictures of Artimat machines around the country, and to find one near you, visit our website at wfdd.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. For 88.5 WFDD, I'm Bethany Chafin.
This is Triad Arts Weekend, and up next we go behind the scenes with Wake Forest University Professor of Communication, Film Studies, and Women's and Gender Studies, Mary Dalton.
If anybody doubted it before, I think we all know now that Netflix has really arrived. Not only are they getting big numbers for Orange is the New Black and House of Cards, their original series, but they have the credibility that Emmy nominations can bring. Orange is the New Black is nominated as comedy series, and I'm not sure I always think it's a comedy, but that's okay. That's their category. And in directing, writing, and various performances. House of Cards is nominated as best drama series, also in directing, writing, and various performances. The shows are easy to access if you haven't seen them because they're both streaming on Netflix. You can watch them anytime you want for the monthly subscription fee. I've been thinking a lot about why season 2 of both shows is just a little bit less satisfying for me than season 1. Orange is the New Black is set in a women's prison, and House of Cards is set in Washington, D.C. in a political landscape that it appears to me is populated by even bigger criminals. One series humanizes the characters a little bit too much, and the other dehumanizes too much. Both of them leave me feeling that a little bit of dramatic middle ground would be an improvement. Two online posts started me on this path of thinking. Allison Samuels wrote in the Daily Beast that she won't watch Orange is the New Black because, quote, "I'm simply not entertained by shows that feature large numbers of black people exiting, entering, or already in prison." Context is everything. And sometimes, maybe it's a little too much. Allison Rosenberg asked the question in her Washington Post blog whether Orange is the New Black has to humanize everyone. That really struck a nerve with me. Once the character Red, for example, was feared Now her backstory is softer and sucks us in. You know, there's so much that this show does right. And learning the backstories of the characters is essential to establishing the larger cultural context that makes me see the series differently from Allison Samuels. I want to watch it. But still, there are times when I think the balance was tipped this season. Not so with House of Cards. I prefer the structure and aesthetics of Orange is the New Black to this series, but that's not my biggest problem with it. House of Cards dehumanizes everyone and everything in the service of promoting Frank and Claire Underwood's hideous agenda to accumulate as much power as possible. It's a dark, dark view with no truth and no possibility that I've seen so far of redemption. I just don't think unadulterated cynicism is a direction that serves us well as a culture. Maybe this is why I can binge watch Orange is the New Black, but House of Cards, I have to take a break between episodes.
Wake Forest University Professor of Communication, Film Studies, and Women's and Gender Studies, Mary Dalton. You are listening to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm technical producer Eddie Garcia. We have to take one more 60-second break, but when we return, the music of MC Taylor, a.k.a. His Golden Messenger, live in Studio A. Stick around. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm Eddie Garcia. Our look at this weekend's Crossroads concert series continues with His Golden Messenger, live in Studio A.
I'm David Ford. Southeastern Center for Contemporary Art, SECA, is proud to announce His Golden Messenger and William Tyler as the co-headlining artist for the 10th installment of its Crossroads at SECA concert series. His Golden Messenger is led by MC Taylor, one of the finest singer-songwriters in America today. The band's fourth release, titled Poor Moon, was given a nod by none other than David Bowie, who calls it mystical country, like an eerie yellowing photograph. We're sampling from the album right now. Just some things that grab me. When my ship comes in, I'm going to lose control. I'm not going to dance till my ship comes in. But what's your ship coming in that case?
I'm not sure. It could be anything. It could be good tidings and good fortune. Or it could be the catastrophe that I've been waiting for. It could be something final that has yet to arrive, but I know is imminent. I mean, it's a song about uncertainness and insecurity, I think. And it's a kind of reckoning with this kind of force, maybe, that is, I understand, to be bigger than myself, but that's all I understand so far.
Does the birth of your son come into play in this song at all?
I think that my son's name is Elijah. He's almost 3 and a half. His arrival influenced all of Poor Moon, certainly, because all of a sudden I was concerned with a whole different set of worries or situations. It's been wonderful. I love him so much. And he changed my life for the better. And so I suspect his arrival is one of the reasons why this set of songs, and certainly the songs that we've recorded since Poor Moon, because we've recorded another record, are really the sort of thorny set of issues or thoughts about how we can't be sure of anything. Nothing is guaranteed.
Yeah, of mortality. And then the inherent good in a little person like that you don't see any other way.
Oh, yeah. It's really beautiful.
Well, let's hear a little bit of, if we can, Call Him Daylight.
Sure.
And thanks for bringing your guitar to Studio A.
You're welcome. Here we go.
Hey there, big as night, think I'll call him daylight. And I'll call him once with a little song. Oh, he's got nothing on, comes naked with the dawn. And I know that I will call him daylight. Knock once and now knock twice. The moon is sacrifice to the one that they call him daylight. All those in my own friend, been a long time coming. I called all night and I was afraid. You come at such a time as you see fit, no compromise. That's why will I call you daylight. Well, I'm moving nevermore. What children go, some call you destroyer, some daylight. And I'm not gonna dance, well, I'm not gonna dance, well, I'm not gonna dance until my ship comes in. But when my ship comes in, whoa, when my ship comes in, whoa, when my ship comes in, I'm gonna lose control.
I really enjoy this tune. We just heard a gorgeous, just you and your guitar arrangement of this. And I enjoyed the studio recording with your band, His Golden Messenger, just that driving bass line, much like the Blue Country Mystic. And just talk about creating a great groove.
Well, I have what I consider to be the greatest rhythm section in the Southeast. Scott Hirsch, who plays the bass on the Gold Messenger records, is someone that I've been working with for 20 years, since we were kids, pretty much. We grew up in a tour van together. So he's very good at reading me and my musical thoughts with very few words. Our musical influences are in sync. We're often listening to the same records without talking about it. He lives in Brooklyn now. I live in Durham. But he flies down a lot, and we do a lot of recording together. And our drummer, Terry Lonergan, who actually lived in Winston for ages, lives in Durham now, and he's just an absolutely phenomenal drummer. I mean, he's sort of steeped in that style of Southern American drumming that I just love. And I almost feel like you have to be from the South to be able to do it.
What does that do to you, MC, the performer, when you're up on stage and you know you're surrounded with these guys that you've been playing with for years, in terms of the feeling, the confidence, or just the state of mind?
It's helpful for me as a musician because it allows me to focus only on my parts. I don't have to think about what anyone else is doing. I know that they've got my back, so to speak. It's very liberating.
Jesus shot me in the head. My initial thought was an interesting way of saying an epiphany, or, you know, a born-again moment.
That's what it's a play on.
Yeah.
You hear, you know, you hear this. People are often talking about their conversions, their rebirths, in this heightened language that I sometimes find a little silly. At the same time, I have complete respect for people that experience a rebirth in that way. That's wonderful.
Sure. This is Jesus Shot Me in the Head, and MC's playing right here live in Studio A.
I'm bound for Nazareth town with all those mistakes I made. God is good and it's understood, but he moves in mysterious ways. He sawed on my father off, woman rough and ready fence. In fact, I was getting wrecked in a Motel 6 when he showed up in the bath. So goodbye, sweet Genevieve. Now goodbye, my Tulsa fans. Oh, hey, everybody, did you hear the news? Jesus shot me in the head. Just as well I was gone to hell. Oh, I'd wasted everything. Oh, no more shooting pool, no getting drunk. No, no, I'm gonna see the king.
Singer-songwriter MC Taylor. His band, His Golden Messenger, and William Tyler will co-headline Crossroads at SICA number 10. And you'll find links at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts.
Well, that's all for today's program. Our executive producer is David Ford, and our associate producer is Bethany Chafin. Our intern is Michaela Nance. You'll find archived episodes and podcasts on our website at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. You can follow us on Twitter as well at Triad Arts Speak. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. Email your questions, comments, and suggestions to triadarts@wfu.edu. For 88.5 WFDD, I'm Eddie Garcia. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.